It's episode 138 of the self-hosted podcast, and unfortunately, my co-host Alex wasn't feeling well, but Brentley stepped up, and he's joining us today, and we have quite the conversation coming up. Hey, Brent.
Well, hey, Chris. Thanks for having me again.
I mean, the timing kind of worked out as you literally just got new hardware in for an extension of a project we've talked about on the show before, so.
I do it for you.
It's kind of perfect. I wanted to tell you about something that I recently got, kind of a Black Friday deal, actually.
Oh.
It's not really a computer piece of technology.
Okay.
But I guess it's technology. It's a UV flashlight. One of these, like, little portable ones.
Okay. Why?
It's called the UV Beast. And the nice thing is it doesn't dim after a few minutes like your typical UV lights.
Oh, good to know. Okay.
And it's got a USB-C charging port, too.
Oh, well, that is actually quite nice.
Yeah. Yeah. Fast-ish charging, I suppose.
Fast-ish.
And it boasts a user-centered design. Our R&D, which are separate, the letter R and D, our R&D people are not sleeping, it says.
Oh, that's not good. I need them to be well-rested, right?
But you know what? I needed to get me a UV light. You know, there's a lot you can do with this, right?
Well, I've been trying since you introduced this idea a couple of minutes ago to figure out what the heck you would be using this for, but I've come up with very little.
Do you have any guesses?
No, that's the problem. I've got nothing.
Well, I think really the question is what can't you use a UV flashlight for? Of course, it's used in the medical field, different types of UV lights. Of course, it's used
for
in tanning beds
and stuff. Yeah.
Sure. You know, secret messages. Absolutely. Oh. Finding cat urine on the floor of a studio. It does do that.
No
it
does, way.
It does do that.
No.
I can attest. It does do that. Well, I actually got it for working on a future car project. There's a family car member has just this really insidious oil leak. Can't really track it down. And I found this oil that has a little bit of a fluorescent dye in it. And so that way when it's designed, so when it leaks out, you hit it with the UV light you can see where your oil leaks coming
from. That is so cool.
It's also just really fascinating to shine around your house. It's one of these gifts that it's something I'm thinking about giving as a gift, but like if you give it to the wrong person, they could go down a rabbit hole of like trying to clean everything. Because boy, you shine this thing on doorknobs. There's a whole society living there.
Really.
Oh, it's bad. It shows you things you don't want to see.
Yeah. Okay. Does it come with a warning that suggests that maybe just flash it at things you want to know about?
You know, if it did, I sure didn't. I didn't read it.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I didn't read it. Probably does, because it probably tells me not to shine it in my eyes or something.
Huh. Does Levi see this thing? Does it affect him I'm thinking, you know, those dog whistles that only they can see? Is it?
You know, I haven't shined it at him yet.
Well, that's probably a good thing.
But it is a lot of fun. You know, you'd be surprised what you point at and lights up. Rocks, blankets, people. I mean, it's pretty fascinating stuff. It's like a whole other world.
Wow.
A whole other universe.
I kind of want one now. I knew not about these 5 minutes ago, but now all of a sudden I'm feeling the craving.
I'll put a link to the one I got in the show notes. So speaking of stuff we're getting, you literally today just got your hot little hands on an Odroid H4 Plus, which I'm very excited to hear about. And actually, but before you get there, can you kind of get us up to date? You got a NAS now, and now you're building another NAS, and it sounds like you're using the Odroid H4 as the source machine, as like the platform machine for that. Get us up to date.
Okay. Well, I've had this like big project in mind, which is to build out a NAS locally for me here that holds a whole bunch of hard drives. We looked at that two episodes ago, 136. And so that thing's been built, and now all of a sudden I've got this momentum, and part of that master plan, if you will, was to build a smaller NAS at my parents' place, both to offer them backup services. They do have something in place, but it's running off of, it's basically an octopus of USB drives that are plugged into an old ThinkPad T61.
Oh, okay.
They've gotten something like, you know, 15 years of service out of that thing.
Wow.
And so my father told me the other day, hey, Brent, There's a lot of noise coming out of this thing.
Oh, no. Fans are going or something.
Exactly. Which is classic with those, right? And they're not meant to run 100% of the time. And I've already taken that fan apart and oiled the thing. So, you know, I think it's probably time. So I've known this for a little while. And now that I've gotten this NAS built here in my cabin, I figured, well, let's just march along on this plan and build out another small NAS that I can replicate data from here onto the hard drives and then ship them to my parents' place a couple provinces over. And then I can use that as an offsite backup and they can do the same on my end. So that's kind of going to be part of the deal.
Oh, I think this is a brilliant idea. I mean, gives them a nice upgrade, but it gives both of you the ability to use each other as offsite backup, which is just brilliant there. It strikes me, though, that this is probably not quite as powerful as the one you set up before, if it's going to be based on the Odroid.
Yes. I decided that they would have very different requirements, and mine is likely a little overbuilt as is, having taken Alex's old server hardware. That said, it allows me to do a bunch of tinkering, you know, run a bunch of stuff that I otherwise didn't necessarily need to run on a NAS box, so... I see a lot of playing in my future.
Right, whereas theirs is just going to be sort of set it and let it just run, and the one that's on your LAN, you're going to be doing a lot more experimentation with. That makes sense.
Exactly. And I already have a collection of hard drives here as well that I want to plug into my NAS here, where for them, they really just need two drives that are mirrored and are reliable. You know, they don't need 5 to 7 drives all plugged in and live or anything like that. So it's just a simpler setup. And I started looking at, you know, buying a motherboard and like all this stuff. And I kind of decided I hate building PCs. I think there's a new realization for me. So what the Odroid offered me was a nice balance between building my own thing and just having a thing that works out of the box.
I agree.
Because, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to build like a computer. And I opened up PC Part Picker and like, okay, they had my case in there, which is I already have a case I'd like to use because otherwise I have zero use for it. And yeah, I just went down a rabbit hole for like 3 or 4 hours. And I was like, I have made zero decisions. This is terrible. So I decided to just abandon that route. And you've talked so highly about your H3 and you've recommended that I get something similar that I just thought, yeah, I'm going to go down that route. I've been pretty, let's say, allergic to single board computers because in my experience with like the Pis, they've been finicky. And like, if you want them to be reliable, you have to do these workarounds and stuff. So I've been pretty discouraged from them. And when I have built one for like a Pi hole or something, it's just not lasted that long on my network. So, but when I was looking at the H4 Plus specifically, it just kind of solved all those things that I didn't like about single board computers. And it also was flexible enough, as I'll talk about in a moment, to use this old case and be compatible with like some of the gear I already had around.
The thing that I really just completely agree with you on is it's a real sweet spot between building the entire machine and still assembling most of it yourself. And the H3 won me over because it had SATA ports, and the H4, I believe, adds more SATA ports, which sounds even better. So tell me a little bit about the specs.
Yeah, so I chose specifically the H4 Plus, which is, I guess, the mid-tier in the new H4. They have just the H4, and then I think the other one's like a H4 Ultra or something.
The Ultra, yeah.
The Ultra.
Yeah, I don't know if any of the storage stuff changes, but I do know you go from 4 cores to 8 cores with the Ultra.
The Ultra does have a different processor. Yeah. So the H4 and the H4 Plus have the N97 processor. And I guess the Ultra has an i3, something like that. I didn't really look at the Ultra that closely, I got to admit. And I probably should have from part of this discussion, but really the N97 is going to do everything I need it to.
The N97 is just a sweet processor in terms of power usage, but still giving you, you know, features for a NAS.
Yeah, I have to say kudos to Hardkernel. They make the Odroid. Their product page for the H4 is a Linux user's dream. Like, they've got a bunch of stats there, but they also go into the reasoning why they chose, like, then 97 versus then 100, which has actually quite a good reputation for little things like this. But man, for prep for this show, I just kept scrolling, and they have, like, a ton of information on, like, benchmarks that they ran about power consumption for Linux uses specifically. So power consumption is an interesting one here, and these are like real life metrics that they've actually used, which is like, for a person like me, is exactly what I'm looking for. So they have like, okay, here's the power consumption for Ubuntu desktop booting, 15.7 watts, GNOME desktop at idle, 6.2 watts, and all that stuff is like super appreciated. So I just think whoever wrote that page, it's probably a team. They did an amazing job. They won me over, that's for sure. And so I don't know. It hit all the buttons for me.
Good resource. Yeah. And I'm curious, how power sensitive are your parents? And that was kind of one of my questions. Is that why you went this direction and say, because you probably could have gone on eBay or something and got yourself a used server or even a 1 liter PC for a couple hundred bucks that would have done a pretty good job. But yeah, I was just looking at these numbers here. Headless server idle, 2 watts. The other one that's really impressive is full-on CPU stress testing. This thing's still only pulling 20.5 watts.
Isn't that incredible?
I mean, that's... So how power-sensitive are your folks?
Well, they, I would argue, they aren't power-sensitive at all. So that wasn't the main reason I chose this thing. Now, it is running 24/7, so that's a nice to have. I mean, I'm going to throw a couple hard drives at this thing, too, so that that power consumption number will go up, of course. The hard drive spinning themselves is going to take probably as much as this whole computer. So I would say they're not sensitive at all. I know that was a huge decision for you that hit a sweet spot with the H3 and your power situation, especially when you're off the mains. But in this particular case, actually, not at all. And my power setup, because I want to slot this thing into a classic computer case, I have like a micro ATX case that I want to shove this thing into, I'm just going to use a standard power supply. So I will probably lose a bunch on the inefficiencies of running that power supply at such low capacity as well, I would assume. So yeah, power wasn't really an important aspect here, but compatibility, I guess, was.
Well, you know what is nice about low power, especially when you're deploying machines that it's a bit of a favor of the for the family to run it. I mean, it's nice for them too, but a bit of it's for you. It is nice if you're not sucking down a bunch of power just for their power bill, but also usually it means quieter.
Mm-hmm.
So less power and quieter. That's a nice to have when you're deploying at a family member's house, unless they have a spot where they don't care. But in some cases, you know, you're putting these things in dens or something like that.
I think you hit it there. Like, volume is a huge consideration. The way, at least we have it set up currently in my parents' place, they have in their basement, they have a bit of a media center, let's call it. So they've got, you know, super comfy couches and it's nice and dark in there. And my father has an amazing sound system that he, you know, loves to watch crazy movies on. And so that's like where they go in the winter to hibernate in the evenings. And that's, you know, almost every evening they're going there to kind of enjoy their time. But just behind their television is like a false room. So there's this little, it looks cool, like a speaker grill that's just hanging with a French cleat on the wall. You take that speaker grill out and it's a little doorway to get to this like secret passage back there.
That's so neat.
Yeah, and when they bought the house, the person who built the house was like a super tech person who like put Ethernet in every single room, including the toilet. And he would use this as like the service cavity for his media center. My parents, I guess, don't have anything quite that crazy, but it's been a useful place to put this little server computer. So right now it's just a little laptop. You know, there's Ethernet back there. There's plenty of power. It's fairly accessible. It stays, you know, very temperature regulated throughout the year because it's in the depths of their basement. And so it's actually the perfect place for this kind of equipment. But it is right behind their media center. So the reason my father earlier said, hey, that computer's getting loud, is that it's literally right there when they're trying to enjoy, you know, TV or movies.
Trying to watch a movie and they hear this.
Yeah. Yeah. So sound is a big one. I would say power is not as important as volume is on this thing. So being able to run this fanless, if I wanted to, is interesting. I think I'm leaning towards actually adding a fan to it, because this case already has a couple fans, and keeping those hard drives cool will be an important aspect too. But if I can put good quality fans and it doesn't really need much cooling, then I think they can run pretty low.
Okay. This all makes sense, but you've hinted at something a couple of times, and I've got a question. Unraid.net/self-hosted. Go unleash your hardware and check out Unraid 7. The release candidate is here, and it is packed full of game-changing features and full ZFS capabilities. Unraid is a powerful and easy-to-use operating system for any self-host or home labber out there. If you've got some disks, you've been meaning to set up a server, maybe have a little network-attached storage, this is the time. Go make the most out of your hardware, no matter what you have on hand. Different size drives or manufacturers, that's not a problem with Unraid. Go check it out and support the show. Go to unraid.net/self-hosted. And if you didn't know, Unraid now has integrated Tailscale support. How great is that? They've got a great video that shows you how to use it. It's such a nice thing to have on your server like this. And you know, when Unraid does it, they do it right. So they've gone full integration. When you install it, almost any Docker container gets the ability to connect to your tailnet. You can access them using valid HTTPS certificates and give them alternate routes to the internet via exit nodes. You get to integrate Tailscale into Unraid. It's like your peanut butter and your jelly coming together. Unraid is flexible, it's easy to use, it has a brilliant UI, and Unraid 7 makes it even better. Go try it out and finally take advantage of that hardware you've had sitting around. Stop worrying about it and just start building it. Unraid.net/self-hosted. So you mentioned the case for a moment there, but you have two cases in a sense, right? Because there's this little kit that you have that the Odroid sits in, and it's kind of like a tray of some type. And then you actually have a much larger case that this is then going to get installed inside of. So it's like a computer case inside a case. What's going on with the case situation, Brent?
Mm-hmm. I think this is where it gets a little unconventional. I think your H3 is just like tucked away in a cupboard, and it's pretty bare bones, right? Like
it's like just it's a bunch attached of wires. It's attached to the inside of a wall, right? And the inside of a booth. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's fine because no one's looking at it or anything, right? I wanted a nice little package that I could ship to my parents that kind of looked nice-ish, but mostly that was self-contained, that didn't have all these wires that, like, maybe in shipping something got disconnected. So I wanted it to be like a plug and play appliance for them when it arrived, because I'm going to ship this thing, so it needs to like come out of the box and be ready to go. That said, I wanted the hard drives to be contained in this box too. They currently are using these USB connected hard drives, and I don't know, that just feels a little uncomfortable to me. I know USB's come a long way, but I guess I just wanted to build a box. So what I've done here, which the H4 afforded me to do, is they sell this little mini ITX kit. It's like a conversion kit, if you will. And it's just a couple panels that you almost like Lego together that attach to the H4. And it allows the entire computer to kind of slot into a mini ITX, what do you call it, the back panel, basically?
Oh, no kidding. So like what would normally be the back ports of a motherboard for a mini ITX machine is actually the Odroid?
Yeah. Yeah. So you're getting, it's this really nice balance between like the classic look and feel and utility of a computer in a computer case versus the single board computer lifestyle.
I see. Boy, this answers my next question, which was, how are you using a traditional ITX power supply to power an Odroid? It comes with a little conversion adapter.
Yeah, and it's relatively simple. So on this panel that slots into the mini ITX slot is a big chunkin' power button, like an on-off switch, which is really nice to have. And they have a few connections to that that just plugs into your standard power supply. and so the on-off switch then basically controls the power supply. And that power supply also provides power to the H4 and the hard drives.
Incredible. So you've got this mini ITX kit. You assemble that, and then you slide that into a micro ITX case. Mm-hmm. And that is where you're going to house the hard drives and everything else. And that'll be what you ship them, is that whole box.
Yeah, exactly. And then when it arrives, all they have to do is plug Ethernet and power in and hit the go button.
Oh, man. That's slick. Oh, that is really cool. I had not. Is this ITX kit new for the H4?
Yeah, it really is. And it's $15.
Ah.
So you can have it too.
Yeah, that's really neat that it comes with that conversion kit, so you can use the standard power supply and it just wires it all up for you. It's like you don't need a huge machine with a massive motherboard and big desktop processors in this for this job. This is so perfect for what you're using it for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of stumbled across this, and I've had my eye on the H3 for a while. And since the H4 came out, I was like, Chris is like raving about this thing. I wonder if I should like look at it more closely. And when I did, I realized, oh, actually, this solves a lot of problems for me and does so in a really nice way. So I've got that in the house. So I sent you a nice little video of me putting it all together. However, this came all the way from South Korea very, very quickly, like within 7 days, which I didn't expect. All the estimates I saw, at least for Canada, were like 2 weeks. So I was not very good at procuring the other parts, so I don't actually have an appropriate hard drive or memory for this thing. So
right. It uses DDR5, and you know, you got to say, do you just have DDR5 laying around? I don't.
Well, I thought I could steal some out of my current laptops, and turns out, nope, that's not the case.
Dang, that'd have been fun at least for a minute, so you could at least play around with it.
Yeah, but one thing I like too is this thing can handle a lot of RAM. So they advertise up to 48 gigs, but they kind of describe in the description that that's just what they tested. So it could probably go up to 64 easily as well.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I bet.
So yeah, there's a lot of like future proofing on this machine in that regard, which I really like.
So you get four SATA ports on this tiny little thing. You get two and a half gigabit Ethernet ports. And then when it's sitting there, it's just sipping the power. I assume, although I would be curious, maybe not, are you going to try to lift as much of the config from your existing NAS that's already built and drop it on this guy once you have disks and RAM? Or is it a totally different build and config? Like, what's your thoughts there?
That's a good question. My idea was to create basically twin NASes. So to have those configs be as similar as possible. That's also one reason why the H4 being x86 is really attractive, is that
sure,
I can run literally the identical software on it as well.
But they do have, I mean, they're going to have pretty different, I should say, hardware specs and different disk layouts, aren't they?
Well, I have identical disks and identical.
Oh, okay.
So I have here in my current server, I have installed, if you remember when we did this, 4 20 terabyte drives.
Yeah.
And we mirrored those in pairs, with the whole idea being that one of those pairs will actually belong to this H4 NAS.
Gotcha. Okay.
So I have it, you know, locally in the NAS I built a couple of weeks ago because, well, I didn't have another computer and I was thinking I could just mirror all that information. So when I ship it to my parents, we don't have to do all that over the internet. So those two will be destined for this H4 server. So the hardware is very similar, other than the computer itself, I guess. But the drives themselves is quite similar. There's just going to be a couple little differences in the config there. I'm using NixOS on both ends. So I'd like them to be as similar as possible, barring obviously some of the hardware is quite different. But other than that, I want them to be quite similar.
Well, I think it's a good idea. And, I mean, you've been thinking about this for a while, so it's nice to make decisions many steps ahead of time, like you did with the disk layout, so that way when everything lines up, you can deploy. So the obvious question is, are you going to put Nextcloud and Jellyfin on there? Like, are you going to set them up with some media? I mean, I know they probably have a good setup already, but like, is the temptation there to like get them on anything new?
Well, that's where I think I still have some decisions to make. I think Jellyfin is a no-brainer. They've got a ton of DVDs and stuff that actually my father has been ripping, and we've ripped in the past, and they have tons of music and things. So if that just be connected to their media center, which is like, you know, 3 feet away, that's an easy win. So yeah. Jellyfin, 100%. They don't necessarily need to access that stuff from a distance, but I mean, I can set that up too, which would be a nice thing. They have far more stable power. They have far more stable internet than we do here. So having that stuff be accessible, even just to like our little nuclear family from that particular machine is completely
one central spot too. Totally. Yes, Brent. Oh, I'm so supportive of all of this.
Like, so I'm not making any mistakes yet.
I love it.
Your other question though was about Nextcloud, and I don't know yet. So I have really wanted to duplicate your setup of having a local Nextcloud, so not on a VPS. I've been a little nervous with how successful the Nextcloud instance I've built like 6 years ago has been. I, as you remember, have something like 10 active users on there now, most of which is family, which is amazing. Like having them not be uploading their stuff to all these, you know, huge mega big corp cloud providers is a good feeling for me, but that also puts a bunch of responsibility on me, and I am feeling more and more uncomfortable having that be accessible to the public internet. So having a local Nextcloud is very attractive. I just don't know how to do that in a way that's simple enough, because, you know, the more features I share to my parents about, hey, you could just share this folder with your accountant once a year whenever you need to, you know, share some information with them, instead of my father used to give them a USB drive and it would sit on their desk all year, you know?
Right.
So he's been using some of the features where a public accessible Nextcloud instance is actually really nice. So bringing a bunch of information privately in their home and using Tailscale to access it is really nice, but it takes away some of that public functionality. So that's still something I have to solve. I think I would be totally open to hearing what you and Alex and listeners think I should do in that regard. Like, I can manage having two Nextclouds, right, and moving information between them.
Sure.
But
sure, yeah,
I'm not convinced that's a good route for the family.
I would like to punt that to the audience too. Maybe they could boost in. What would you do for those things you just need to temporarily make public from something private? I have the same thing with pictures. Now that I upload everything to Image, I know there's like public image proxy and there's ways to do it that way. I would prefer to just have something I can temporarily make public, a link or something like that. I'd like people to boost in. And, you know, I think, Brett, where I was going is, I think it's part of a broader conversation, one that I've been mulling over with the family about not just cloud services, but messaging too. And I kind of wonder if we have a window of opportunity to make a pitch to family. You know, because you and I have been talking about this kerfuffle going around that this salt typhoon hacker group that's gotten access to the U.S. telecommunications networks.
This is so fascinating.
Yeah, they're using law enforcement backdoors. These Chinese hackers are using law enforcement backdoors to monitor U.S. citizens.
Good for them. Now, that's what I say.
And, you know, instead of shutting down the back door, they're just telling everybody, hey, you need to start using encrypted end-to-end chat.
I want to know how you feel about this, because we privately have talked about, you know, all these backdoor kind of stuff, especially in all of the three-letter agencies at the U.S.
And I mean, I do think there's a conversation there
for such a long time, etc. And all of a sudden,
right? now everybody should use encryption. Yeah. And also, there's a conversation around like how critical are these monitoring and surveillance systems? Are they so critical that we are going to leave them on so the Chinese can use them?
Right. But also,
Yeah.
Even as simple citizens, like, we saw this coming. This is pretty obvious. Like, if you leave a hole, someone will eventually find it, right? Even if you don't intend them.
And this just proves that point, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is why we don't want to have backdoors built into stuff. because while it might have been secure when they designed it 20 years ago, it isn't now. And I'm trying to find the silver lining. And the silver, and we'll have links in the show notes if you guys want context what we're talking about. But I think the silver lining might be you're seeing a lot of the U.S. federal government all of a sudden become pro end-to-end encryption. Like, the Department of Defense,
like all of a sudden, you know, in a day.
Yeah. But like maybe this is an opportunity for us to have a conversation with the family saying, hey, did you see that the FBI and CISA and the Department of Defense and, you know, Senator Ron Wyden have urged everyone to adopt end-to-end encryption because of a compromise that's happened? You know, maybe it's time to get off the built-in text messaging app that comes on people's cell phone. Right. And this holiday, we could move them to something more secure.
Well, I think actually you're onto something there. I'm curious, where should people go? That's always the real question, right?
That's where the conversation. Yeah. It's like if you're a family unit using an xCloud instance, I mean, maybe nextCloud Talk is a very reasonable solution. If you have people that's outside of that, I think, you know, I'm a big fan of SimpleX or Simplex. We've used it.
Yeah.
And they keep going from strength to strength. And if you look at the one that seems to have received the most propaganda against it recently, it's Simplex, right? Because it's Wired had an article calling it the neo-Nazi messenger of choice simply because you can use it without a cell phone.
Yeah, but they kind of said the same thing about Signal as well, right? When that first came out, I know you have to, when Signal first came out, you need a phone number, but like burners exist, etc. And, that's basically been the propaganda against any well-made encryption communication.
When I was in high school, I had a beeper for the ladies, and I had a teacher assume I was selling drugs and give me like this whole interrogation because he assumed I was a drug dealer because I had a pager. It's like, yeah, it's wild. So I really like Simplex. I know you like it. I think Nextcloud Chat could be an option. Obviously, Signal is really popular as well. That seems to be another thing people could. You know, I think getting them, step one is getting people off of SMS in your friends and family circle. Step two, I think, is then maybe getting them off of things like WhatsApp and Telegram, even though I use Telegram a lot. I don't think those are the best either. And I think the full level is like something that you host, like a Nextcloud Talk or a Matrix or a Mattermost or a Simplex, whatever it is. I think that's like the best tier if you can, but you know, you got to have a pretty tight group of people for that.
Well, and up till recently, Simplex was pretty hard to self-host, but there's a bit of a change here recently, isn't there?
I don't know much about this, Brent, but they are introducing in 6.2.0 Flux servers, which I guess is like some kind of decentralized network. I don't know. They say it's a user-operated decentralized cloud, and it supports significantly advances the decentralization and privacy of a Simplex network. I guess the key benefit would be if Simplex were to go offline or Flux were to go offline, the system still operates, or you could host your own node, that kind of stuff. I don't know. I got to look into Flux. Maybe anybody out there knows anything about it. If you've ever hosted anything on the Flux servers, that's new to me.
Yeah, it seems pretty interesting because they keep pushing. You know, they had a pretty good setup when they first came out, Simplex, and it had a lot of features, especially against things like Signal, that were a little bit more private. They didn't have usernames and things like that. But it's nice to see them continuing to push the envelope and to push things to be even more decentralized and even more, I guess, unrelying on them, if I'm understanding this correctly.
Yeah, no, I think that is right. They're trying to make it less reliant on them. You don't see that very often, do you?
Yeah, they say here, the app can randomly choose 4 to 6 servers from multiple operators for each connection, following a 2-hop onion routing model that prevents metadata leakage. So this is like taking things to the next level. Simplex offers full decentralization, unlike Matrix or Tor, which have central components or shared user identities that can expose metadata. So it sounds like the golden goose to me as far as encrypted messengers go, but it's still new. I think we've got to poke holes in it.
Tailscale.com/self-hosted. Go try it out for free for up to 100 devices and 3 users. Go to tailscale.com/self-hosted. That's not a limited time deal. That's the deal. That's the plan. That's the plan I'm on. And I've been on it for a very, very long time. Tailscale is the easiest way to connect your devices and services to each other wherever they are. And it's powered by Wirecard. Secure remote access to your databases, to your applications, to your servers, to your Kubernetes cluster, whatever it might be. And Tailscale is fast, really, really fast. It's intuitive, it's easy to use, and ultimately it's unlocking programmable network, and it lets you manage networking like it is code. You can deploy it, you can set it up with rules. It's really powerful. What you're building is a zero-trust flat mesh network that connects each device directly to each other, so you get a flat tailnet. And if you have a node on a VPS and you have a node on your home LAN and you have a mobile device, they all exist in this virtual tailnet. And then in there, you have all kinds of tools and capabilities. Like you can do name resolution, you can move files between your systems, you can have them talk directly to each other, you can host applications inside this tailnet. And that's what I've chosen to do. Jellyfin, everything I run at home, anything new that I'm standing up, all of it. And I don't even bother putting it on the internet anymore. I just have to put it on my tailnet, and then I just connect my nodes to the tailnet, and I can get access to everything. No inbound ports at all. It makes old VPN systems seem, well, like legacy systems. It's one of those things where once you've experienced it, you've gone through a bit of a networking awakening, and it really fundamentally changes the things you can do with networking. You don't have to. You know, you could just use it as a VPN if you want, but it's so much more than that too. And it also ties in with your existing authentication infrastructure. So if you're a business and you've been thinking about giving it a go, you can still go to tailscale.com/self-hosted, try it out, and then tie it in with your overall business authentication scheme. Take advantage of whatever it is you use to log in your two-factor system. You just get started by going to tailscale.com/self-hosted. That's tailscale.com/self-hosted.
Well, Chris, you've been suggesting I get Jellyfin basically on all of my servers, both at my parents' place and over here, but I got the feeling this comes from something. Have you been on a Jellyfin kick recently?
Have you heard the good word, Brent? Have you heard the good word of Jellyfin?
I have heard the good word.
Oh, man. I have been so thrilled with my transition to Jellyfin, and it really has gone from win to Jellyfin win. And I got a couple of things that I thought I would share with the class this week. First of all, WatchState. It's a tool that syncs backends between Jellyfin, Plex, and Envy.
Oh, no.
Across different servers. Yep. Syncs your WatchState.
This is what you've been asking for.
It is, Brent. Because, you know, I have the privilege of having a Jellyfin system at home and a Jellyfin system at the studio. And I sometimes watch something at the studio, and then I get home and it's unwatched. Like an animal, I have to sit there and go individually mark them as watched. Ha! Oh, never again, I said. Never again. So this is pretty sweet. It's a really nice little project, and they've been working on a web UI for it that adds more and more configuration options. On October 7th, they added a bunch of more stuff to the management web UI. And really, I think brings it to something that I thought about, but would have to do everything via config file to now, hey, I just got to get the basic Docker Compose up and going, and then bang out the rest in the web app.
Nice.
That's where they've gotten recently.
Can you explain what this is doing on the back end? Like, how is it syncing these libraries?
It's speaking to the API. So you go in and you put the like the API of your Plex server, the API of your Jellyfin server in there, and it's identifying the same items, figures out how they map in each other's database, and then it's flipping the watched bits for you. What could ever go wrong? Nothing, probably. Probably nothing. Probably nothing could ever go wrong there. but I want it so badly, Brent. I just want it so badly. I've been also experimenting with something called, and I have not set this up yet, but I've been experimenting with how to bring the family's attention to particular things that are on the system. It's the holidays, for example, and I'd like to surface certain playlists, surface certain movies or libraries. In fact, I have holiday libraries that I turn off during the non-holiday seasons because my family, like just out of nowhere, was watching holiday movies all year long, and they were burning themselves out. And I'm like, this cannot stand. And so I isolated all of the holiday specific stuff, like all the Christmas stuff, all of the Halloween stuff. You know, I isolated those different things, and then I turned those libraries off, and then I turned them back on when it's seasonally appropriate, young man. And this, I think, could be a great way to help surface this. It's called the Jellyfin Featured Content Bar. and it gives you a little UI. It's a plugin. You got to make some changes, but it gives you a little UI area to draw a certain attention and kind of feature certain things on your Jellyfin box. I think that's a really great idea.
So you're kind of advertising to your family. This is what's happening, yeah. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, look at the new stuff. Check it out.
Little
check
nudge, it out. Nudge.
And then I wanted to just close the loop, and I wanted to mention Infuse 8, because I've gone on and on about this for so many years on the show as the absolute pinnacle of video playback for set-top boxes. It's an app that's available for the iPhone, iPad, and Apple TV. And I still think that the Apple TV is probably the best set-top box in terms of performance and features, especially when you combine it with Infuse. Then I switched to using Android again, and I stopped really talking about Infuse. And the sad part about that is they've had really a couple of kick-ass releases. So I'm back on the Apple TV, experimenting with how I can integrate that into Home Assistant, which has gone very successful. And it means I've had a chance to try out Infuse 8, which has a totally modernized infrastructure that handles much larger libraries and takes advantage of the new features in Jellyfin, like segment capabilities and intro segment tagging, and brings true proper intro skipping in Jellyfin and credit skipping into Infuse. It's so nice. Imagine the best of every, like, you know, the best of things about MPV, the best things about Kodi, the best things about Jellyfin, then distilled down to their most core elements and then put into an app that is extremely responsive, that has extensive local codec support, and has a group behind it, Firecore, that has one mission: to make the best possible video player on the iOS platform. And what you get is Infuse. It is the one I go to every time when I need to save the dad moment. This just happened the other night. Finally got a chance to watch Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. Great movie. I hit play, the incredible epic music starts. Right? And I'm like, yeah, it's building, but there's nothing on the screen.
Oh, no.
Okay. And that's weird. My wife's looking at me. She's like, is it just black for a while? I'm like, no, I mean, they did that for the motion picture, but they didn't really do it after that. And I bring up the play bar, and I have their signal on the television, and I look down, and it's got all the chapters. All the chapters have images, but the playback is just black. And I'm like, oh my God, no.
Worst timing,
because we've been trying to watch Star Trek VI for probably 3 months. So I quickly had to do the old HDMI swap. I swap back over to the Apple TV, and I fired up Infuse, and it immediately played the video without any problems, full HDR fidelity, which might have been what threw it, it was an HDR version of the movie. Infuse handles that just fine. The TV's HDR, it all just works. Mwah, chef's kiss. So all of this together is really made for just the most incredibly, incredibly nice media center setup that feels like I really kind of have built something here that I own and control, that works offline, that's using the open source stack. Infuse is a paid app. You don't have to use it. You could use the Jellyfin app. But when you bring it all together, it's so smooth. It's so fast with the proper intro skipping now, a proper video player. Oh, the Jellyfin wins just don't stop.
Do you think that you nailed the timing to transition?
I think I could have done it sooner, but for a couple of things that I really, really wanted as core features, I think I nailed that timing. I think, you know, people that switch sooner would probably say, no, you could have done it sooner. They're probably right. I do miss Plex sharing. So there's still, at the studio, I still have a Plex server running for friends and family that still use that. But for us, it's all the Jellyfin. And I think that the timing of that switch just really stuck. A couple of the challenges we've done on the show have just really stuck recently, like the no Google stuff. Still no Google searching over here.
Really? Nice. Yep. That's great news.
Pew, 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 pew. Look at me go. I know. I'm really, when you get to lean into this stuff, it's nice to stack a few W's.
I guess the real question is, what's the next challenge?
I don't know. That's a good, you know, so I wanted to ask the audience, Have you ever had a self-host fail? Like something you went to go set up and you either couldn't get it working or you got it working and it blew up in your face? We're coming up on the last episodes of the year, and there's got to be some good stories out there. Could be a good time to share those.
I have so many of these. So many. This has been like a 7-year journey to building these NASs for this very reason.
Yes. There's been a few in my history as well. What have you failed to self-host? Boost in and tell us. KEEB.io/self-hosted. Keebio. Go over there, sign up for their newsletter, and take 5% off your first order. Keebio, they specialize in beautiful, well-built open keyboards. A lot of split keyboards, the ones I really like, but they also have those regular types for you folks that don't want the split keyboard. On Black Friday, keep an eye out for one of their keyboards that's a lot like the Microsoft Natural 4000, which was a great keyboard back in the day. But this one's even more ergonomic, lots of options, and it's going to be at a great price. Their keyboards come fully built, or you can get in a kit and assemble it yourself. And a lot of the parts you're going to have no problem with because everything is hot swap, so there's no soldering for any of that kind of stuff. They also have macro pads with like 9 to 16 keys. I use that here in studio for my OBS machine. There's all kinds of things. You could do like a homemade Stream Deck with that thing, or maybe you want to have like a home theater PC control board or shortcuts for Home Assistant. Those are really, really slick. And because of who they are, they also have lots of DIY parts like microcontrollers, and they support open source. They publish 3D printed parts, and they're part of the Core QMK firmware team, and all of their keyboards use QMK. If you're a keyboard person, you know that's a big deal. So go check out Keebio. It's keeb.io/self-hosted. If you sign up for the newsletter, get 5% and get yourself a keyboard that deserves to be touched all the time. You're interfacing with your hardware all the time. If you're anything like me, why not have it be great? Why not have it feel great? And why not have it be something you can repair and fix that runs an open firmware? Support the show and check them out. Go to keeb.io/self-hosted. That's keebio/self-hosted. Speaking of which, we have some great boosts. Wine Eagle came in with 25,000 sats from Breeze, B-R-E-E-Z. And they write, all this talk about the perfect NAS and no mention of ECC RAM.
Fair.
The N100 for Jellyfin box, but I'll stick with an AMD for ECC. I do really like ECC, you know, error correcting RAM. I don't know, though, if it is as necessary in modern CPUs. I'd really love somebody that knows their S on this to write in and tell us. Because I've been told that error correcting RAM is not as necessary anymore. I have to imagine it's still good, but I've been told it's not as necessary. If I have the option, I'm going to choose it.
From all the research I did on this very topic, it sounds like if you can do it, like there's no downside other than, you know, price and hardware availability.
That's the downside.
Yeah. I guess it is, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But I have heard repeatedly that it's not quite as necessary as, you know, it's not essential, but it's a super nice to have. So, yeah, it's a, I guess, a personal opinion thing at this point. But if you can, then go for it. There's no reason why you shouldn't. Extra protection. It's like insurance. I'm just trying to justify why I didn't, and I'm doing a bad job. Well, Glavada boosted in here 2 boosts for a total of 24,692 sats.
Hello.
Thanks for the great show. For anyone doing envelope budgeting, check out actualbudget.org. Definitely note the .org, not .com. Recently switched to this self-hosted open source project from You Need a Budget after the latest price hikes, and I'm loving it. Keep up the great work.
Oh, that's great to know. Actualbudget.org. Well, thank you for the boost. Good to hear from you again. Biodrone came in with 22,222 sats using Fountain. We have been blown away by the feedback and support that the Smart Home Index got since we boosted into episode 137.
Nice.
As promised, we're returning part of that value back to self-hosted and will continue to do so. That's great.
Amazing.
To answer Alex's previous question, we have a contribution page up at smarthomeindex.org/contribute. That's where the community can thank you. Smartindex.com/contribute, where the community can submit a new device or a bug or feedback directly. Based on the feedback, we've also begun integrating a public GitHub repo for collaborating on self-hosting notes, which is linked from that page.
Nice.
That is really cool to hear. Yeah, so check these guys out, smarthomeindex.com. Remember, we talked about this where they have the listing of compatible devices and the ecosystems and their ratings and their prices. Such a great service. That's smarthomeindex.com. Nice to hear from you, BioDrone. Thank you.
Well, the Dart Frog boosted in 20,000 sats from Fountain. Hey. I'm considering moving workstations to a full-time Linux box, but on Windows, I use File Jiggler to move and archive my files. It's a very important software for me. And so the question, what would you suggest for Linux? Also, okay. P.S. I want a weekly self-hosted show.
So you're using File Jiggler now to move and archive files.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's called File Juggler. I misspoke because I think Jiggler is pretty funny.
This feels like there could be a lot of options here.
Well, I did a little research on this one because I was like, what in the world is File Juggler? So it looks like File Juggler does some automated workflows with your files. And it can like read file content and rename it automatically and move it automatically for you based on some rules that you create.
Oh, okay.
Which sounds surprisingly compelling. I thought all of a sudden, maybe I'm not doing such a good job organizing my files. And so I guess the concept here is that folders are a bit deprecated and there are better ways to do so. Or, you know, why should a human do it? Let a computer do it. So File Juggler is only available on Windows. So I did a little research to try to answer this question to find some alternatives. Now, a website I always go to for this as a good starting point is alternative2.net. So we will include a little link to that. It's a little sparse on Linux, I gotta say. There's a couple other options that are proprietary and like one for Mac only and such, but I wanted to find open source Linux-based options here. And there's a couple. I don't think the feature set will be a perfect overlap, but you can at least start your adventuring and let us know which one you pick. So I found something called Made, which is a command line tool that accomplishes a lot of the same goals. You can write little rules and it will automatically organize files for you. Now, I don't think it has a GUI in the same way that File Juggler does, but I think the underlying feature set is actually quite similar. So you might look at that. I also did find something called Organize, which we will also link to, which considers itself a file management automation tool, which sounds exactly what you're looking for.
So Made and Organize.
Yeah, exactly. I think those are very similar in functionality. Basically, they have rules and try to organize your files in an automated way for you. The way that you write these rules differ between the two. So I think, you know, it's a bit of a personal choice there. And I think they don't have GUIs. So, but I think it's the kind of thing, once you set up rules, it just kind of works in the background and does the thing you're asking it to. So maybe you don't need
it. And then you could back that file up and maybe that's kind of nice because you can just copy it around. This must be a thing more people do, is have software that they define rules and it moves files around for them. It's not something I've ever really employed. More so on the back end sometimes. You know, Nextcloud actually has kind of like a flow tool that lets you do some of this too.
Yeah,
so
a bunch of file automations. That's true.
Yeah, there's different ways to do it, but let us know. I encourage this switch to the Linux workstation. I think it is the workstation of the future for all power users.
The other thing is, if you only have one tool that's keeping you from going, like that's, you've already made the switch. Like just go for it and you'll find a new workflow or something that is equally good. I do want to surface one last pick in my research. I don't think it does what you do. It's called Tag Studio and it just looks at a completely different way of organizing your files. So like forget about folders. Everything is just linked through like tags that are multi-level and multi-linking, and I want to surface it because I think the author did a really amazing job of selling it to me, and now all of a sudden I'm looking at it. But they did an amazing video, which I think is also kind of funny, that we'll link in the show notes.
Dav comes in with a row of ducks, 2,222 sats. Set him a first boost to the podcast that got me hooked on JB. Yeah, very well done. Thanks for taking the time to get that set up. I know that can be a path. As a student, the budget is tight, but self-hosting and the tips in the show have helped me cut down on subscription costs. At least that's what I keep telling myself. While simultaneously, I'm building a skill set I can use at work. Thanks for the great input and to many more episodes. Oh, thank you. And thank that's you for, awesome. I'm sure, you know, I'm sure it was probably a little bit more of a pain in your butt than you'd like to set up the boost and all of that. So I really appreciate you taking the time to do it, Dav. It's great to hear from you.
Well, the Cypher Seeker sends in 2,500 sats.
Ew.
I work in commercial HVAC controls, and I've seen a Raspberry Pi compute module 4 used with a cell modem on a rooftop HVAC unit. Can you believe this?
No. I mean, yes, but no. CM4, that's great.
It's the kind of HVAC unit you'd put in place. I believe the purpose was for the unit to be able to phone home to the vendor and report system information for warranty purposes. Huh.
Ah, sure. Yeah. Yeah. I could see that, like a little separate system running there, collecting the metrics and all of that, and then reporting it back. Probably a little Linux system. Some Debian system running an old Linux kernel, phoning home.
Yeah, I want to know how they were like weatherproofing this thing. I guess you just shove it in the HVAC unit somewhere and just let it dangle.
Just a lot of epoxy. And yeah, you just
yeah, epoxy solves everything. A Cypher Seeker also has a last question here. P.S. How come Alex isn't in the splits for the boosts?
Oh, yeah, Brent. How come you haven't convinced Alex yet to take a split?
Why? Can I take a split on the episodes that I sit in?
You should. Alex, you know, we cover him other ways for doing the show. Don't tell him that he's missed out on over 100% gains. Don't tell him that part. But that's how he likes it, and we're fine with that, too. That's just how, you know, each host over the history of JB has usually had some arrangements. And that's fine. We also have ads on the show that can help cover, and then JB gets a cut, and then JB portions that is part of the factor of what the hosts make, too. So it all works out in the end. Woodcarver comes in with 11,486 sats. Ooh, I like the 486 there. Regarding what Raspberry Pis get used for, one good example, synthesizers.
What?
The Korg WaveState and the TastyChips GR Mega are both Pi powered in some way. According to Korg, cost cutting, oh really? And the Raspberry Pi Foundation's longevity commitment were key reasons for making the plunge. Yeah, I guess it kind of becomes like a general platform at one point, you know? I wonder if Editor Drew knows of any, if you've heard of any of this.
I was literally going to say, is this actually a cameo from Drew? Because like this is exactly what he would be into.
I wonder if he's heard. Yeah, he's probably going, oh yeah, of course. That's great. I love it. Thanks, Woodcarver. That's a good one.
Sam Squanch comes in with two boosts for a total of 4,500 sats using Cast-O-Matic.
Oh.
On the Obsidian synchronization front, I discovered a plugin called Remotely-Save, which lets me sync between devices. I use my email provider's WebDev as the share, and so far, never had an issue. Works on iOS and Linux for me quite nicely. They have a paid version with more features, too, if you want it.
Hmm. Boy, that could save some money. That's my really only downside to Obsidian is I think to really use it across all the devices, especially iOS, you got to kind of pay for Obsidian Sync. And then I just kind of wonder, well, should I just have like WikiJS on a server or something? But Remotely-Save looks like it could be a way to save a little bit of money there. Thanks, Squanch. Nice to hear from you, too. Nice to hear from all of you. Thanks, everybody who decided to boost in and support this episode. It means a lot to us. And your sat streamers out there also, we're here from you. 30 of you, actually. Look at that, Brent. Wow. 30 folks just nice. Streamed sats as they were listening.
That's impressive.
And they helped us stack 45,865 sats. When you combine them with our boosters, now not every boost made it into the show, but we do have the boost barn linked to the show notes, and we do read all of them and put them in our show notes. But for time, we didn't get to all of them because we had 39 unique senders this week. And collectively, we stacked 170,094 sats. Thank you, everybody, and thank you to our members. Each production gets supported by our listeners directly, and we really appreciate it. You can boost, too, and get in on the fun by getting something like the Fountain app and Strike, or build it yourself with Albi Hub and find a great app that you like over at podcastapps.com. And you'll find a link to the self-hosted 138 Boost Barn in the show notes. Before we go, Brent, I have an app that I have been meaning to mention for a bit, and the Matrix chat reminded me last week of SyncThingFork. Now, you've probably heard of Sync Thing, and you've heard of people trying to run Sync Thing on Android.
It's true.
But have you heard of Sync Thing Fork?
I sure have.
Oh, okay. Good.
Yeah, I guess there's been some, I don't know, troubles with Sync Thing, or they've stopped developing the Android app. And that seems like everybody still wants it. Now, Sync Thing Fork, when I first came across it, was, it's got to be 2 years ago. And they, at the time, were just implementing a couple features that weren't being done upstream fast enough. I think that was probably, they were seeing sort of the writing on the wall there. And so, as far as I understand, this thing has been around for a while and is quite stable. And lots of people are using it.
And it adds a few nice features that the original didn't have. You know, it's got Sync Thing camera, an optional feature where you can take pictures with a friend or a partner on two different phones, and you'll save into one shared private Sync Thing folder. That's a
great idea.
No cloud required, just between the devices, right? I mean, that's pretty neat. And that, and your other Sync Thing instances, little stuff like that. Sync every hour. So you could kind of save battery, but still have a pretty fresh sync.
That makes sense.
That's a nice setting. So I just wanted to give them a shout out because it sounds like you and I have both used it. I don't use it actively, but have absolutely used it. And huge proponent of Sync Thing in general. And the Matrix chat was like, how come you haven't mentioned this? I'm like, I actually did have it on my list.
Doesn't everybody just know about it? I have a Sync Thing confession.
Okay.
If you'll hear it.
Go ahead, my son.
I have failed miserably at Sync Thing. I tried Sync Thing, when I heard about Sync Thing Fork, which was about 2 years ago, because I thought, geez, everybody continuously talks about how much they love Sync Thing. And I was thinking, instead of sending my stuff to the internet, especially like photo backups, I'm in my cabin most of the time. I got this little NAS. Well, at the time I had a really... Let's not talk about the NAS I had set up, but I had a NAS set up, and I thought, I'm just going to sync stuff locally here instead of sending it to the internet and back. And I just failed miserably. Like, I found it really...
What do you mean you failed? That's like saying I failed at carrots. No good at carrots. What do you mean you failed at Sync Thing? It's like you turn on a Sync Thing server, you turn on another Sync Thing server, they find each other and they sync.
Yeah, good question. I found it really difficult to configure in a way that it was reliable. So I kept playing with it and playing with it, and it was to the point where I was just configuring it a lot more than it was finding success. And like, I don't know if anybody else has had this issue. Like, what am I doing wrong? Someone hold my hand, because...
What were you configuring? What do you got to configure on this thing? You just turn it on.
I guess. I don't know. Maybe I was jumping into configurations. I mean, there's not like a lot of settings. Oh, man. So I was doing it totally wrong.
Maybe there are.
Okay. Someone tell me what I should and should not do, because I want to try this again and find success, but I'm scared.
It is pretty solid. At least I've been using it pretty solidly for years. I do think, actually, I mean, I tease. I think I had a couple of first passes at Sync Thing that didn't actually work out for me. I think my current implementation, which is probably about 4 years old, was probably my third rollout. I probably figured it out by my second, but the third time I've really nailed it, you know?
Okay, so I'm on track here.
Yeah, I think you might be. I tease, but yeah. Yeah, it's for me, I find Sync Thing works the best for like back-end directory-specific moving across systems where I almost treat it like a network file system in a sense. So an example could be, a bunch of files get rendered and dropped into a directory, and that directory just syncs across three different servers. So those servers always have the source files, and any one of them can always go to work. And I didn't need to like set up any complicated file system sync, because it's just this one render directory. And sometimes I want to add an extra node, and sometimes I want to remove a node. Another great example is like I might have I do not have a single DVD player or Blu-ray player at home at all. But I do have one here at the studio. And in the past, I have been able to rip a Blu-ray, save it to the folder, and then during the day while I'm working, it syncs to my home system. And then when I get home, I just sit down and it's already on my Jellyfin server and I hit play.
Yeah, okay, that's slick.
That's really nice for that kind of stuff. So shout out to the old Sync Thing. The problem is that if you want to play around with it on Android, it's getting harder. I think even the Sync Thing fork is perhaps no longer on play. So this could be a good opportunity to go embrace our friend Obtainium. Brent loves Obtainium. I love Obtainium. Great way to get apps directly on your Android device without the Play Store. And then you can just go get the APK off their GitHub. And it works.
Nice and fresh.
Real good. Brentley, is there anywhere you want to send people? Any place they can go find more of you?
Oh, I think the best place to find me on a weekly basis would be Linux Unplugged. Go check me out over there, along with, well, you and Wes.
I want to give a shout out to our members. Our SREs keep the show going. They get an ad-free version of the show with a little extra, a post-show. You can sign up and support the show directly. Put your support on autopilot at selfhosted.show/SRE. If you want to try the wild side, I'm on Nostr, chrislas.com. We'll send you over to my Nostr profile. I'm on WebinX, too, if you want. And I'm in the Matrix. That's good, too. Every now and then I make a rando appearance in Discord. We have a great Discord community over there as well, and Alex is often in there, so shout out to them. Links to what we talked about today will be at selfhosted.show/138.